Hey friends, this episode of The Fellow on Call is not meant to be used for medical advice and is intended for educational purposes only. Patient information has been modified to ensure privacy. The views expressed in this episode do not necessarily reflect the views of our employers. Enjoy!
Welcome to another episode of The Fellow on Call, the Hemong Podcast. We're coming at you from Rollo University Medical Center. I'm Ronak.
I'm Vivek.
And I'm Dan.
And today we kick off a new series, this time focusing all about chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL, also the cousin of SLL. And over the next few episodes, we're going to go through the ins and outs of this disease. And as we were foreshadowing in our previous series, this is the perfect setup to come up after we talked about hemolytic anemias, because sometimes we happen to see patients that get diagnosed with CLL, and hemolytic anemia is their initial presenting issue. So I'm really excited to sort of continue that discussion that we had set up just a few weeks back.
Yeah, I'm all about going into a hematologic malignancy. I see a ton of CLL patients in clinic all the time. So I'm excited to share some of the insights I have with listeners and some pearls that I've picked up from other people and just running through the data, the natural history, the risk stratification, all the stuff, everything CLL. So we'll be doing everything CLL over the next couple of weeks.
You know, CLL is, I think it is the only malignant heme condition that ever really tempted me away from nine heme. It's a really fascinating disease state, and I'm excited to get into it.
Well, let's roll that show. Guys, I think it's been a moment since we updated our listeners about what Dan currently has in his wine cellar. Dan, I forgot to tell you, I took a wine tasting class with one of my friends here at Rollo just last week, and I was reflecting back to when you taught us about how to process wines when we're tasting them, you know, with the smell and the color and the texture and the flavors. So I meant to ask you what you were drinking the next time I saw you, and here we are.
I'm always excited for an update on what I've been drinking. You know, it's wintertime. We're not going for beach wine that we might reach for over the summer. I've mostly been settling into a little bit thicker, maybe a little sweeter reds. I also want to put a big shout out for a grape variety called Nerello Mescalese. It's a sort of Sicilian grape variety. It's probably most similar to like a Sicilian Pinot Noir, but lighter skinned. So definitely seek those out.
And if you were to go with my recommendations here, I recommend going to Costco. Looking at the price tags and the bottle of wine that's in that $10, $15 range, but it says 90 points big on the label, it's probably good. Honestly, that stuff is really good. I don't know what 90 points means. No clue. But I do know that a $15, $10, $15 bottle of wine from Costco, really good idea. Trader Joe's, another great place. Have no idea what I'm getting, but it tastes good.
I was just going to ask if either of you have ever had Trader Joe's wine before. I'm always tempted because it's like $4 for a bottle, but I don't really know what's in there or what I'd be getting.
You just got to do it, man. You just got
to
do it.
That sounds good. I'm open to that idea. Maybe the next time I'm at Trader Joe's, I'll pick up a bottle.
But when in doubt, when you're at dinner, just text Dan and be like, hey, man, which bottle? I texted him one time at a French restaurant. I'm just like, Dan, which of these million listed wine bottles should I get? And he tells me exactly what to do, which is good.
Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah. I am always open to that. It fulfills my love of telling people what to do, my love of wine, and spending other people's money. So it's like it's a real three-pronged attack for me.
If you want some consulting help with wine, please email us at thefellowoncall@gmail.com, and we'll be sure to connect you with Dan the Man Housewrath.
Okay.
All right, Joel. Well, I am certainly excited to embark on a new journey on our CLL and SLL series. In today's episode, I think we can kick this all off. CLL, at least in my experience, is one of those diseases that makes a lot of people really nervous because there are people that are walking around, as we'll discuss, I'm sure, with really high white counts, but some of them are completely asymptomatic, and it seems always a little bit weird being like, hey, you have a leukemia and your white cells are really high, but you're feeling good, so we'll see you in a few months. And hopefully we can dispel some of the worries that people have about this disease, and most importantly, figure out and educate our listeners about when to treat, and more importantly, how we treat our patients. So Vivek, in our usual fashion, do you want to kick us off with a case?
Yeah, let's do this. So this is a patient I saw a couple days ago in clinic. We have a 63-year-old female with no past medical issues who presents to our clinic for evaluation of leukocytosis found on routine labs from a primary care provider 2 weeks ago. Her CBC 2 years ago was obtained and unremarkable, but this most recent CBC showed a white count of 40,000, hemoglobin of 14, and platelets of 265. Notably on her differential, she had a predominant lymphocytosis with an absolute lymphocyte count of 32,000. A peripheral smear reported smudge cells, and we ordered flow cytometry to better characterize the phenotype of those lymphocytes, which showed increased B cells with the following abnormal immunophenotype: monotypic for kappa, positive for CD5, CD19 bright, CD20 dim, and CD200 bright. This pattern was characteristic of CLL, SLL, and now she's asking us, hey, what does all this mean? What do we do next? So before we get into this, let's start with the smudge cell, because, you know, we always hear about smudge cells. Everyone gets this consult. A lot of internists see this question. So can one of you tell me exactly what a smudge cell is and why it's not pathognomonic necessarily for CLL?
Yeah, a smudge cell, I mean, it pretty much looks like what it sounds like. It's a little smushed-looking thing on the smear. It's kind of like a purple blotch. What they are, it's really a remnant of a leukocyte, of a lymphocyte that's been smushed, so all you can see is just the remnant of the nucleus. It's because these cells were large, fragile, and just got damaged and destroyed during the process of smearing the blood on the slide. There's a lot of different reasons why we can see that on a blood smear. It doesn't exclusively occur in CLL. It's not just a pathognomonic thing for that, because if there's a viral infection going on, some other stress because of severe illness, anything that makes reactive lymphocytes, which can be kind of large and fragile, can also produce this smudge cell artifact on the smear. So don't necessarily think CLL the first time if you see a smudge cell here and there. If you're seeing a lot of them, like a full field of smudge cells, maybe that points you a little more strongly in the direction of CLL. But end of the day, a smudge cell is a fragile lymphocyte that got smushed when they were making the blood smear.
Yeah, I think that's really important for everybody to understand that you can have smudge cells and it doesn't mean you have CLL. So obviously, this case is different. We had this patient with a high white count, significant isolated lymphocytosis and smudge cells. So for our patient, can one of you go through how the flow cytometry helps narrow our differential? And just in general, what do you think about when you see a lymphocytosis?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Vivek. And, you know, I think first I'll answer the question about how to create a differential diagnosis in these situations. And actually, before I even do that, I know it's simple, but whenever we see patients referred to us with really high white counts, it is super important to ask for that differential, right? Because that's going to tell you, is this a neutrophil predominant issue? Is this a lymphocyte predominant issue? And the way that we react to this number is very, very different based on what that predominant cell type is. So once we've established that lymphocytes are the primary cell type, then it begs the question of what our differential diagnosis is. So this can include things like infections. And so we often think about EBV or patients that develop mono, for instance, can have very high lymphocyte counts. Drug hypersensitivity like DRESS, patients who are asplenic, patients with thymomas, and also, of course, then B-cell malignancies. And when we're evaluating that lymphocyte count, the absolute lymphocyte count is also super important. The infection, if there's an infection there, can result in a lymphocyte count up to the 20 to 30 range in some patients. And then others may be more in like the 5 to 15,000 range. And then we always need to have a very high suspicion for malignancy when that lymphocyte count, that absolute lymphocyte count, is above 30,000. So again, maybe on the lower end of that spectrum, we're less suspicious of a malignant process. Something on the upper end of that spectrum is going to raise suspicions for a hematologic malignancy. We've talked about flow cytometry many, many times on this show, and it's such a good reminder with this disease about why we do that. So remember that flow cytometry is that critical test to help us establish clonality, and it's to determine if the lymphocytes are actually all abnormal and from a single lineage, or if they're all a little bit more heterogeneous. So hematologic malignancies are going to be characterized by abnormal expression of surface markers and or aberrant absence of surface markers. And you should really go back, and we'll put a link of this in our show notes, to our prior episodes where we talked all about this, especially in our HemePath series. But we'll put that, if you haven't listened to that in a while, it's a great refresher. And so remember, you can always use CD marker expression on B-cell malignancies to help narrow this differential. And it's always a good idea to look a chart of this up, just pull it up on Google, but we are going to share some of our favorite reminders with you all. So we can use CD marker expression on our B-cell malignancies to help us narrow the differential. And we're going to give you some of the ways that we like to think about this. So CD5 positive and CD10 negative makes us think that the patient may have mantle cell, which can have an indolent leukemic variant, or CLL and SLL. So CD5 positive, CD10 negative, mantle cell leukemic variant, or CLL and SLL. CD19 bright and CD20 dim and CD200 bright are very consistent with CLL and SLL. CD200 bright is not consistent with mantle cell. So as you can see, this is how you can sort of differentiate what may be causing the problem. So again, just to kind of recap, CD5 is small, and CLL, SLL has small lymphocytic lymphoma in the name. And then I like to think of CD200 as so long and so chronic, so that's also why it's associated with chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And the correlation here with the morphology of the cells is also important. So again, this is all going to be done in consultation with your pathologist, with your hematopathologist. So taking into account that lymphocyte count, the flow information, and also what the cells are looking like under the microscope.
Yeah, it's really important for us to understand what these immunophenotypes mean, because you're going to come across patients who have variant immunophenotypes, and you have to eventually piece it together as a hematologist when you see these patients in your clinic and consultation. So our patient saw their report, come to see us and follow up a week later. And before we get into the information we need for things like risk stratification, indications for treatment, things like that, they ask us, why do I have a leukemia? Do I have a lymphoma? Why is this called CLL/SLL?
This is a very common question for patients to ask, especially when they get a diagnosis like CLL that does have that word leukemia in it. It just makes people immediately think of very, very sick children in a hospital getting chemotherapy, or very, very sick elderly adults in a hospital getting chemotherapy, and not necessarily what the CLL experience might be like for them. When we say leukemia, what we're talking about generally is circulating malignant cells from the hematopoietic lineage in the peripheral blood. For example, you can have a leukemic phase of a lymphoma, like DLBCL, if you see circulating large lymphoma cells. To have a diagnosis of CLL, patients need to have the following criteria: an absolute lymphocyte count above 5,000, like we talked about, and an immunophenotype consistent with CLL cells. We measure that by flow cytometry. So as we know, the B cells originate from the marrow. They start at the same hematopoietic stem cell, that CD34 positive progenitor stem cell. And as the B cell matures, it has a phase where it's circulating in the peripheral blood looking for its home, looking for some lymphoid organ to live in, like a lymph node or the spleen. The naive B cell that enters into that lymph node and starts to take up residence then undergoes further maturation, and eventually it might get exposed to an antigen it recognizes, undergo that somatic hypermutation process of the immunoglobulin heavy chain, and that happens in that structure inside the lymph node called the germinal center. The malignant clone for CLL can either be that naive B cell that's just come out of the marrow and is kind of circulating around looking for a home, or it can be the more mature B cell that has undergone that mutation of the IGH, of the immunoglobulin heavy chain. In either case, the B cells are kind of freely circulating from the marrow and the lymph nodes and kind of flowing between these compartments. And that's why some forms of the disease are liquid or kind of free flowing in the circulation, and other forms are stuck in the lymph nodes and stay as more of a solid mass. In either case, these B cells generally are freely circulating in the peripheral blood and also taking up residence in lymph nodes and maybe expanding there. And just depending on the nature of that cell when it became malignant, when that cell developed into a malignant clone, its behavior may be more of one that circulates freely in the blood or one that's more predominantly stuck in lymph nodes. They're generally going to be in both places. Oftentimes, we diagnose these folks with peripheral blood flow cytometry. Sometimes we diagnose on a lymph node biopsy. Depending on the dominant behavior of that clone, whether it's primarily in circulation or primarily in the nodes, and based on what we did to diagnose that patient, a patient might get labeled with CLL, they might get labeled with SLL. But at its core, there's a strong overlap between these diseases. They're essentially the same disease.
Yeah, and I think that's really important, is that it's the same malignant clone. It's either found circulating around or in lymph nodes, and it's typically in both places. So that's why you have CLL and SLL. You have a leukemia and a lymphoma. Same exact cancer clone, just you either found it floating around or found it at a lymph node. And like Dan said, some of them tend to be more lymph node predominant, and they may just be called SLL, and you're not seeing these circulating CLL cells that you can just pick up on flow cytometry. They may not have a lymphocytosis. And so bottom line is, it doesn't really matter. The patients have both. It's very common for these cells to be found in both the blood and the lymph nodes because that's just where they live.
So Vivek, that raises a really interesting point because when we hear the term, and more importantly, when our patients hear the term leukemia, they're often thinking about really severe hematologic diseases. And for instance, if we think about myeloma cells in circulation, we're then calling it a plasma cell leukemia, for instance. So definitely has a worse prognosis there. On the other hand, though, patients with CLL, some of them actually have a pretty good prognosis. And I know that this can trip up a lot of people, and it's a difficult concept for patients to also understand. So, you know, in our case, you described an otherwise healthy female that's coming in with this suspected new diagnosis of CLL. And so how do you educate your patients based on the normal history of this disease course and sort of what is going through your mind when you're providing that education?
Yeah, I think when you initially see these patients, it's really easy to just tell them CLL is the best cancer that you could ever have and everything's going to be fine and don't worry about it. But the reality is that's not necessarily the case. This is one of the most common types of leukemia that are found in the United States, mainly affects older patients, median age of diagnosis around 70, 72 years old. And there are some patients who will never need treatment, live a very normal life expectancy. The majority of patients will need treatment at some point and often have a very good long-term survival, but there are a subset of patients who follow a more aggressive disease course, so it's important to appropriately risk stratify these patients, and that really guides how often you want to monitor them. So when I'm talking to a patient, I say, hey, this is a cancer. Many patients can have a relatively normal life expectancy, have pretty low-intensity treatment that we can generally avoid things like cytotoxic chemotherapy. I just need more information to be able to give you a better sense of what your prognosis will be. And that's that first conversation when you're meeting them. The things that I really highlight for these patients, what's the natural history of CLL? What happens to it? Well, at some point it progresses. And what that looks like is it's an immune cell of your body. So what does it do? It's a B cell. It secretes antibodies. So you can have autoantibodies causing typically autoimmune cytopenias in some patients. And if you have recurrent autoimmune cytopenias, that's an indication to treat. Some patients will have other just general autoimmune conditions related to their CLL. That could be an indication that you want to treat their CLL. Some patients will just have B symptoms, right? You have this B cell clone, this low-level cytokine release storm. You'll have these B symptoms, fever, weight loss, night sweats, big spleen because they're taking up residence in that nodal organ of the spleen, some early satiety. And those are all really important things to consider for this patient on when to treat. And that kind of gives you, our listeners, a sense of when do we treat this thing? Well, cytopenias that are related to the CLL, it's expanding in the marrow, and I've got anemia, thrombocytopenia, recurrent autoimmune issues, whether that's autoimmune cytopenias or just general autoimmune conditions, and then just B symptoms, right? I'm feeling really bad. I've got bulky lymph nodes and things like that. And I counsel patients that these are the symptoms that we're looking out for and that we're concerned about when we see them.
Okay, so I understand that sort of paradigm as to how we can choose to treat somebody, but is there a way that we can risk stratify patients as well to try and understand what the course of their disease is going to be like? Do we need to get imaging, bone marrow biopsy? Like, what's your initial workup like?
Yeah, it's a really good question. For these patients, oftentimes you'll see, well, I need to get a PET CT for anybody with a hematologic malignancy and a lymphoma, or I need to get a bone marrow biopsy because they have leukemia. But the reality is you have an abundance of circulating lymphocytes that you can get all the tests you need off the peripheral blood. In terms of staging imaging, it doesn't really matter if the patient's asymptomatic, right? I mean, it can give you a little bit of prognostic information, but I would say it's not required for all patients, right? A good clinical exam can give you the information you need. So would I say palpate their lymph nodes? Absolutely. Do you need to get imaging on all these patients? I would say not necessarily until the time that you start treatment to establish a baseline. So in terms of the staging systems, there are two older staging systems that you'll see even today. One is called the Rye staging system. The other one's called Binet staging. And there's going to be a lot of details in our show notes, but I'm going to briefly summarize these. The Rye stage was developed in 1975. So in that original study published in 1975, they looked at 125 patients diagnosed from 1941 to 1971 and said, let's create an arbitrary system. I want to be very clear about that. Rye and colleagues decided what stage 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4 were going to be arbitrarily, and they validated it in this cohort, and they validated it in other data sets. It wasn't one of those fancy machine learning things that you see nowadays, right? They just chose arbitrary numbers. And they said, decided that let's call one of these stage zero because these patients do so well. And that was that low-risk patient that I said that may never need treatment. And stage zero, they defined as lymphocytosis only. Stage one is lymphocytosis with adenopathy. Stage two, add either hepatomegaly or splenomegaly. Stage three was anemia, hemoglobin less than 11. And stage four was platelet count less than 100, thrombocytopenia. So anyway, they created these staging systems, and I would not at all use these to say how long is my patient's survival going to be, because this was done in 1940 to 1971, right? It kind of gave us a sense, though, of there are this subset of patients who never need treatment, right? Those stage zero patients. The second system, Binet, came along, this researcher from France, and the French group did a couple of studies, and initially they created their own staging system, no stage zero, but stage one to four, and they said, well, a lot of these people have adenopathy with their lymphocytosis, that they probably do just as good. And they said, well, their stage one is both lymphocytosis and adenopathy, and they created this staging one through four. Then, this is in about 1977. Then, fast forward to the early 80s, 1981, and Binet said, wait a minute. Let's look at this again. Let's regroup, and let's create another arbitrary cutoff that I'm just going to make up. So what they did is they looked at the Rye staging, 0 through 4, their staging, which used to be 1 through 4, and found out that, wait a minute, stage 0, 1, and 2 all do the same. We're clearly not thinking about this right. Stage 3 and 4 tend to do the same as well, so any cytopenia is bad, so we're not thinking about this right. And then they found, well, multiple nodal sites involved seems to be a prognostic. So they created Binet A, B, and C. A is asymptomatic. I have lymphocytosis and less than 3 nodal areas involved. B is lymphocytosis with 3 or more nodes involved, and Binet stage C is for cytopenias, hemoglobin less than 10 or platelet less than 100. And that set up our modern risk stratification in many clinical trials. So just know that Rye stage 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, does it really matter? Not really. You know, that's not really what's important in 2024. Binet stage got a little bit better, and I actually like Binet stage a little bit more because there are Binet stage A patients who do beautifully well. Asymptomatic, even if they've got adenopathy, I think that's a little bit more realistic. And you'll see a lot of trials used Binet staging to stratify in their randomization.
That's so important to understand the context of where all this came from. And I can't remember when we talked about it, but we said that at some point, people just need to come up with some sort of arbitrary metric to just allow us to start doing exactly what was happening. So it's nice to kind of hear the natural history of how all this had happened. So, you know, in our modern day, as you were alluding to, we have this new risk stratification model. I'm assuming that there's a role for things like FISH and molecular testing to also come into play here. And so how are we utilizing all of this newer, I want to say, information into how we prognosticate our patients?
This is another really critical step that we advanced in CLL. So let's start with 1999 and 2000. At that time, we had two tests. One was a molecular test looking at the immunoglobulin heavy chain. Remember how Dan said it undergoes somatic hypermutation in the more mature B cell? What we found out was if you looked at that and said, are you mutated or unmutated? Meaning, do you look the same as germline or did you mutate? Did you undergo that mutation? The patients who had mutated, more mature B cells becoming their CLL clone had a much better prognosis than unmutated. That was done in 1999. The problem with that was in the early 2000s, 1999, it was hard to run molecular studies on all of our patients, so they had to create surrogate markers. That's why you'll see some areas where you'll read about these ZAP70 expression and CD38. Those were flow markers that were surrogates for this mutation status. Now we don't use those because we can easily get the IGHV mutation status, which is still to this day very important and prognostic. Those who are unmutated have a worse prognosis than those who are mutated. And in fact, we think there's a subset of mutated patients that probably we can cure their CLL. There's a subset of those patients we can cure. Can't say so much about the unmutated. When it comes to FISH, and remember, all this is going in the peripheral blood because we got all these lymphocytes circulating around. There was a study done in 2000 that separated a bunch of different cytogenetic abnormalities, these larger chromosomal rearrangements. What they found was deletion 13q as a sole abnormality had the best prognosis. Deletion 17p definitely had the worst prognosis. 17p is where that p53 gene is located, that tp53 is located, and they had by far the worst prognosis. And then we had everything in between, and one of those in-betweens was deletion 11q. And deletion 11q is thought to be sort of an intermediate adverse risk factor. So you had the best, which was 13Q. Then you had patients that had 11Q, which was sort of intermediate. And then you had 17P, which is the worst. And everything else, normal, trisomy 12, other abnormalities, those all didn't matter quite as much. Those really didn't matter quite as much. So 13Q, really, really good. 11Q, possibly not as good. 17P, definitely bad. And that's really where we came from for the molecular testing and the FISH. And remember, you can get this in the peripheral blood, and then you risk stratify your patient at that point.
Although it is important to keep in mind that a lot of these prognostic studies were done before the era when we had access to the BTK inhibitors and BCL2 inhibitors like venetoclax. So we'll obviously get into that a little bit more in our treatment episodes, but then those are still unfavorable characteristics to have. But yeah, the prognostication may not be quite as grim now that we have access to some of these newer drugs. So it's good to know that we can send all these studies on peripheral blood. Again, if you've ever looked at a smear from somebody who has CLL, it's obvious that we have plenty of cells to choose from, and we can generally spare these patients a bone marrow biopsy. We also do see this CLL IPI or CLL IPI score being used for some patients. How do you use this? How does this come into play? And do you have a threshold for sending a patient for bone marrow biopsy?
I think both of these are really important questions. I would say this. For the IPI scores in CLL, they are completely outdated when we think about overall survival. These are pre-BTK, pre-venetoclax-based treatments. I can't trust that my patient's survival is going to be X amount of years based on those models. What happened was there's two big efforts in finding a good risk stratification, because we had the IPI score in large cell lymphoma, and we've talked about that before. What about for CLL? And there's a lot of effort being done. One was from the German CLL study group. You'll see it abbreviated GCLLSG. We'll link that study in our show notes, link what those prognostic variables were. That's important to know because it became the inclusion criteria for an ibrutinib versus observation study that really cinched the idea that we can just watch these patients and don't have to treat them early. That's why I'm mentioning it now. Check out our show notes. For the CLL IPI, this was published in Lancet Oncology in 2016. What information does this give me? It was very interesting. They identified five important prognostic factors. And what they did was they took eight clinical trials that were run, and they got all the individual patient data and conducted a meta-analysis, which is great. They had nearly 3,500 patients to identify important prognostic variables, and then they validated it in two separate independent data sets. So it's a really, really amazing analysis. What they found was the prognostic markers, the most important was TP53 mutation status. Whether you got the actual mutation status or just that deletion 17P, that was critically important, the most heavily important prognostic variable. IGHV mutation status was also important. Remember, unmutated is bad. Serum beta 2 microglobulin mattered, actually, with a cutoff of 3.5. The Binet stage, A versus B or C, mattered. And age, obviously, younger patients tended to do better. So it's important to note, I didn't mention deletion 11Q. So in this large patient-level meta-analysis of over 3,500 patients, corroborated in two independent data sets, deletion 11Q was not found to have a significant influence in prognosis. So that's why right now, I would say the way I think about it is 13Q is very favorable, 17P is bad. I don't know about 11Q. In fact, it showed that it may depends on age. In the original study, that age, there's an interaction between age and the deletion 11Q. So anyway, long story short, you'll see patients with deletion 11Q. That doesn't mean it's the end of the world. I wouldn't really say that's a terrible prognostic factor because the CLL-IPI doesn't even include it in one of the largest analyses that were done. So that's it for the CLL-IPI. How useful is it now? I think the one useful component of that study, which was like appendix page 32, was that it showed the time to next treatment for these different CLL-IPI risk groups. And the low-risk group, 80% of patients did not need treatment over 10 years. So that helps you, right? It's a natural history experiment, right? You're basically just saying, what if we didn't treat those patients? 80% of that low-risk group would never need to be treated, which I think is really helpful when we think about those very low-risk patients to really reassure our patients, there's a good chance you really won't need treatment. And you can tell that patient, hey, you're going to be fine. Most likely, this is going to be fine. We'll watch you. Everything's going to be good. It can really allow you to have that conversation. In terms of when to get the bone marrow biopsy, I personally don't do it on my patients. Some people do it routinely before they start treatment. Why do I not do it? Because I can get all of the studies and data I need from the peripheral blood. It's not wrong to do it. I don't personally do it. I always get staging imaging before I start because it gives me a baseline to follow.
And just to clarify, with regards to baseline imaging, is there a preference for PET CTs versus MRIs versus CT scans? What's your go-to?
So really, a CT is honestly often sufficient for these patients. The advantage of a PET CT, one key thing you want to think about in every CLL patient when they start developing these B symptoms is, do they have Richter's transformation, a transformation to large cell? Unlike follicular lymphoma and marginal zone lymphoma transforming to large cell, Richter's transformation has a very, very poor prognosis, and we refer many of these patients for allogeneic stem cell transplant as consolidation. The overall survival of 2+ years is only about 20%. This is a very, very serious diagnosis that you need to make, and the PET CT can help you because if there's a big lymph node, you would biopsy the most avid lymph node to rule out large cell transformation. And going along the lines with that for the bone marrow question, if I had a patient who I was really worried about Richter's, and maybe I would say, hey, let's marrow them because we might find large cells in their bone marrow. We might be able to diagnose Richter's from their marrow. If they have really bulky adenopathy and an avid disease and an avid marrow, I would do that. And then in other cases, if they had bad pancytopenia, for example, and I wanted to say, hey, it's an older patient. Do they have MDS or is this from their CLL? That's another reason why I would get a marrow. I know I said I wouldn't get it on everybody, but that's the times that I would do it using clinical judgment.
I think this is a lot of really valuable information, and I want to take a step back and just sort of recap the highlights of what we had discussed. So in terms of what we said today, CLL can be something that's very indolent and largely very asymptomatic for a good deal of people, or I should say minimally symptomatic for a good deal of people. And then there's others that fall on the spectrum with regards to how well they feel with this diagnosis. I think we also highlighted some important CD markers that we need to pay attention to. I remember these coming up on my in-training exams. Maybe you guys saw them on your board exams as well. But CD5 positivity and CD200 positivity are characteristic of patients with CLL. And remember, CLL or SLL, so small, CD5 is small, and then CD200 is so long, just like chronic, as in chronic lymphocytic leukemia. We also talked a little bit about some of our prognostication and, you know, baseline information that we need on our patients. We talked about the current Binet ABC model, as well as the importance of that initial workup. So that may or may not include a bone marrow biopsy. It's important to evaluate the patient and figure out what makes the most sense. If it sounds like if they're largely asymptomatic, it's probably okay to forego a marrow just because you can get a lot of the information you need off of the peripheral studies. But of course, if there's something else that's ongoing, the cytopenias or something just doesn't feel quite right, you can have a threshold to marrow those patients. And then we also want to get imaging to sort of evaluate any burden of disease and consider getting a PET scan if there's even the slightest suspicion that this may have transferred to a Richter's. And we'll talk more about Richter's transformations in a future episode, so don't worry about that. And I think I hit the majority of what we had talked about. Is there anything that I forgot that you guys think is important to highlight right just before we wrap up?
That was really great. The last thing, if that lymphocyte count is less than 5,000, you basically have an MGUS called monoclonal B-cell lymphocytosis. Nothing to worry about. That thing is not CLL. The patient does not have cancer. Remember that 5,000 threshold.
Cool, guys. Well, I think that wraps up a great first episode of introduction to CLL and SLL. So until next time, listeners, we'll see you all later.
See you later.
Peace.